The headlines, Iran says it seeks to enhance cooperation with its neighbors, including Persian Gulf countries, to establish lasting security in the region. Israel launches a fresh missile attack on Syria's capital, Damascus. The Syrian military says air defenses shot down most of the missiles. The Kremlin calls an EU price cap on natural gas unacceptable. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumisha Ahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. Iran says it seeks to promote cooperation with its neighbors and Persian Gulf countries to establish lasting security in the region. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says Tehran is ready to host foreign and defense ministers of regional countries to discuss security issues. He says Iran has repeatedly announced its readiness to build trust and cooperate with its neighbors. The top diplomat also says regional countries should abandon reliance on foreign powers for their security once and for all. Amir Abdollahian made the remarks in an address to the U.S. to the third edition of the Tehran Dialogue Forum. This year's initiative is focused on Iran's policy towards its neighbors. It is attended by 70 officials and representatives from 36 countries. The Israeli regime has launched a missile attack on the Syrian capital, Damascus, in a new act of aggression against the Arab country. Military sources say Syrian air defenses shot down most of the Israeli missiles. The sources added that the attack resulted in the injury of two soldiers but caused no loss of life. The missile was fired from the northeast of Lake Tiberias in the occupied territories in the early hours on Tuesday. Israel frequently launches missile attacks on Syria. Damascus has repeatedly complained to the UN over the Israeli violation of its sovereignty and territorial integrity, urging the Security Council to take action. Calls, however, have fallen on deaf ears. Israeli soldiers and settlers have been stepping up their attacks against Palestinian civilians and the occupied West Bank and other areas lately. The two Palestinian brothers have become the latest victims of Israeli settlers' crimes. A settler deliberately ran over them with his car in Nablus and fled the scene. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has accused the Israeli regime of letting the perpetrators get away with such crimes to further incite such violence.
An Israeli settler has run over two Palestinian brothers near the city of Nablus in the north of the occupied West Bank, making them the latest victims of Israeli settler crimes. According to Palestinian media, Mohammad Motair and his brother Mohannad had stopped their vehicle by the side of the road near the Zatara military checkpoint south of Nablus to fix a flat tire. It was then that an Israeli settler hit the siblings, who were traveling around with their family members at the time, and fled the scene. The victim's relatives said that 28-year-old Mohammed was killed immediately after being trampled on by the settler, while his brother, 24-year-old Mohannad, was seriously injured in the same accident and was later announced dead due to his injuries. Reacting to the atrocity, Hazem Qasem, a spokesman for the Gaza Strip-based Hamas Palestinian Resistance Movement, said the settlers are escalating their aggression against Palestinians. He added that the formation of the new right-wing government in Israel has apparently emboldened settlers to ratchet up their crimes against Palestinians. He described the incident as a new episode in the series of, quote, Zionist terrorism under the protection of the regime's police and army, saying this crime must be answered by increasing the resistance in the West Bank. Israeli occupation soldiers and settlers have been noticeably escalating their attacks against Palestinian civilians in the West Bank and other areas, in an attempt to forcibly expel Palestinians from their lands and make way for expanding Israeli settlements. Israeli forces have also been conducting overnight raids and killings in the northern occupied West Bank, mainly in the cities of Jenin and Nablus, where new groups of Palestinian resistance fighters have been formed. Since the start of 2022, Israeli troops have killed more than 210 Palestinians, including more than 50 children, in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds, as well as the besieged Gaza Strip. Earlier, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs described 2022 as the deadliest year for Palestinians since 2005, when the UN started to keep a tally of Palestinian fatalities. The World Body says Israeli forces have shot dead 19 Palestinians, including 3 children, in different incidents across the occupied territories between November 22nd and December 11th. In addition to the killings, Israeli forces have blocked the main entrances of several villages across the West Bank, disrupting livelihoods of thousands of Palestinians.
And yet another provocative move against Palestinian worshippers. Scores of Israeli settlers have stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds under the pretext of celebrating the Jewish festival Hanukkah. On their part, the Palestinian forces, factions, and commissions have called for defense of Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Scores of Israeli settlers, guarded by police, have stormed the courtyards of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Al-Quds under the pretext of celebrating Hanukkah holiday. Earlier, the Israeli police stormed Al-Aqsa and forcibly expelled Palestinians stationed inside, paving the way for the illegal settlers to storm the compound. Israeli forces deployed heavily inside Al-Quds Old City in preparation for securing the settlers' incursions and preventing Palestinians from entering the mosque. Israeli settlers intend to storm Al-Aqsa for 8 days to celebrate the so-called Hanukkah, also known as Festival of Lights, which extends from December 18th to December 26th, as settler groups promoted the storming by announcing free transportation for its members. Israeli groups and extremist settlers had previously called for massive incursions into the holy site during the Hanukkah holidays. Hardline Israeli officials and settlers regularly storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied city, a provocative move that infuriates Palestinians. Settlers' incursions on Al-Aqsa Mosque frequently trigger clashes that leave casualties among Palestinians. Such acts of violence even led to an 11-day war between Palestinian resistance groups in the besieged Gaza Strip and the Israeli regime in 2021, during which the regime forces killed at least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned the latest raid on Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli settlers. Hamas says such incursions are provocative and very dangerous. The movement has urged Palestinians to mobilize immediately in defense of Al-Aqsa Mosque. The resistance movement stressed the Palestinian nation will make sure to protect the mosque under any circumstances, warning Israel of the consequences of raids on the holy site. The Jewish visitation of Al-Aqsa is permitted, but as part of a decades-old agreement between Jordan, the custodian of Islamic and Christian sites in Al-Quds, and Israel in the wake of Israel's occupation of East Al-Quds in 1967, non-Muslim worship at the compound is prohibited.
EU member states have finally reached a deal on setting up a price cap on natural gas in a bid to tackle the energy crunch triggered by the war in Ukraine. A spokesperson for the Czech Republic, which holds a rotating presidency of the bloc, said The energy ministers have finalized a price limit of 180 euros per megawatt hour. The deal follows weeks of talks on the emergency measure that has split opinions across the 27-member bloc. It includes a package of measures to help the members protect their citizens and businesses from extreme price volatility and paper for the next winter. The Polish Prime Minister says the new compromise will put an end to what he called Russia's manipulation of the market. Moscow, however, has described the move as, quote, unacceptable, saying the cap is an attack on market pricing. The price cap will come into effect on February 15. Our correspondent in Brussels, Jerome Hughes, tells us more.
Really, this is a joke, a complete joke. And there are still major divisions within the EU on this particular issue. You mentioned the figure of 180 euro per megawatt hour. Well, actually, the European Commission's original proposal, and as you mentioned, there have been so many emergency meetings now, I think almost 10 emergency meetings from EU energy ministers. Well, their proposal from the Commission was 270 euro per megawatt hour. And that's because the European Commission realizes that if you put the cap too low, basically you're just not going to get any supplies. And you have countries like the powerhouse, the economic powerhouse, like Germany was saying all along, that actually energy security and supply is actually more important than affordable price. Because this is all very great in theory, putting on caps, etc. But at the end of the day, if you don't have a supply, then what's the point of the cap? And actually, you had Netherlands and Austria, they abstained in this vote today, Monday. But also you had a situation whereby Hungary voted against it.
Since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, the U.S. has been one of the staunchest supporters of Kiev, providing the country with billions of dollars in military aid. Now, for the first time, Moscow claims that it has shot down four U.S.-made missiles over the southern Russian region. In our news review program, we discuss the issue with our guests. Let's take a listen.
News review time. Now, Russia says its air defense systems have shot down four U.S.-made missiles and one of the first such claims in nearly 10 months of fighting with Ukraine. Russian Defense Ministry is saying its forces have shot HARM missiles over the Belgorod region. That's a southern Russian area that's regularly hit by Ukrainian strikes. The ministry also says that Russian forces have shot down eight Ukrainian drones. They've also intercepted six rockets fired from the U.S.-made HIMARS and the Soviet-made Uragan multiple-launch rocket systems. Okay, to discuss this, I'm inviting a couple of guests, our own Jana Miller, who is live for us now in Moscow and watching developments in Ukraine. Also with me is Greg Simons, who's a researcher with the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies in Uppsala, Sweden. So, Johnny, beginning with you, bring us an update on the latest regarding the war between Russia and the Ukraine, and also these U.S.-made weapons that Mr. Zelensky has been begging for all this time. Looks like many of them are just going down the drain.
Yeah, so at the moment, the frontline fighting is concentrated around Bakhmut. The Russians have been trying to take that city for a while. If they are able to take it, that opens up the rest of the Donbass region. It seems to be their primary objective. At the moment, that area has been called a meat grinder for Ukrainian troops, as Russia is overwhelming artillery superiority there. And as you say, Zelensky is calling for more and more weapons. At the moment, NATO is not giving Ukraine its most advanced weaponry. It's given the HIMARS system, a very effective missile system, but it's holding off giving other weapons. I recently spoke to a Russian politician, more hardline politician here in Moscow, who said that Russia has far greater military capability that it's not using, and that they could destroy whole Ukrainian cities if they chose to. One of the dangers is of NATO giving more technically advanced weapons to Ukraine, if Ukraine was to ever strike further into Russia, if it was to ever hit Moscow, for example, we could well see huge repercussions from the Russian side. So at the moment, this war is there is more stages of escalation that this conflict can reach, and it looks like it's going that way rather than in terms of peace talks at the moment.
Okay. Now, Greg Simon, speaking of U.S. supplied weaponry, I mean, there are some Western media that are trying to fool the public, maybe especially in the U.S., that the U.S. does really care about the allies, including Ukraine. But some others are there, and analysts, and they're saying, they're arguing that this is only a proxy war that Ukraine is fighting for the U.S., for the West, spearheaded by the U.S., and they're getting victimized. And the main aim is to simply undermine and weaken Russia. How do you look at this?
Well, I mean, Americans have not been shy about calling what it is. It's a very, shall we say, advanced level of proxy war, because their investment in the proxy war is massive. But, I mean, they've been saying from even before the war began, when you had the likes of Nuland, Victoria Nuland and so forth, saying that they'd have a war in Ukraine which would be used to weaken Russia militarily. And, I mean, you've had the likes of speakers and representatives of the House and so forth. They've been saying things openly. They've been saying, for example, as so long as we keep supplying Ukraine with weapons, they'll fight to the last man. I mean, this is not concern for a so-called ally or whatever. I mean, this is purely pursuing their own selfish geostrategic imperatives at a time of the decline of American hegemony globally. I mean, as Kissinger said himself at some stage, America has no permanent allies or permanent enemies. It has only permanent interests.
Okay, appreciate the contribution. John Miller in Moscow, Greg Simons in Uppsala, Sweden.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In the U.S., two men from Tennessee have been arrested for allegedly plotting to kill FBI agents who were investigating them. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the story. In the latest in an ever-growing list of criminal charges brought against January 6 rioters, a Tennessee man was arrested on Friday, 16th of December, for allegedly plotting to kill the FBI agents who were investigating him. With the House of Representatives Committee on the Insurrection preparing to deliver its final recommendations on Monday, 34-year-old Edward Kelly of Maryville, Tennessee, was charged with conspiracy, retaliating against a federal official and solicitation to commit a crime of violence. Edward Kelly was already facing charges of assaulting a police officer during his participation in the 6th of January 2021 riots. Austin Carter from Knoxville, Tennessee, was also arrested and charged for his involvement in the plot, according to the U.S. Justice Department. The two men allegedly had a list of 37 law enforcement agents they planned to assassinate, including the agents who arrested Kelly in May for his involvement in the January 6, 2021 attack, and those who were present for a search of his home. An unnamed acquaintance who alerted law enforcement officials to Edward Kelly's plans obtained a list from Austin Carter, as well as a thumb drive from Kelly's home that showed a video of law enforcement officers approaching his home on the day of his arrest, according to court papers. The acquaintance also captured several recordings of Edward Kelly and Austin Carter talking about their assassination plans. At one point, Kelly asked the acquaintance to stash some stuff at his home, later clarifying that he meant weapons and ammunition. Kelly also told the acquaintance he planned to recruit people to attack the FBI's Knoxville office, according to the papers. Austin Carter allegedly told the acquaintance about his plans to participate in Kelly's plot, urging the acquaintance to definitely make sure you got everything racked, locked up, and loaded. Also on Friday, another January 6 rioter, who is a QAnon supporter and self-described poster boy of the insurrection, was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Douglas Jensen, a 43-year-old from Iowa, was sentenced to 60 months in prison after a judge ruled that he had led rioters into the breached Capitol building and towards the police officer Eugene Goodman, actions that could have led to mass death. The developments are just the latest in a meticulous and effective law enforcement investigation that has aimed to hold the January 6 attackers to account. As of 7th of December, 964 people have been arrested for their involvement in the 6th of January 2021 insurrection, charged with a number of crimes including assault of a police officer, destruction of government property, and theft. The list of those arrested for their involvement is expected to grow as the FBI continues to look through media and video footage from the Capitol attacks. Of the 964, about half, or 465, have pled guilty. The longest sentence to date has been for former New York Police Department officer Thomas Webster, who got 10 years in prison in September after a judge ruled he assaulted a police officer with a metal flagpole when the officer tried to defend the Capitol building. The Los Angeles Times has also covered the same story. Newly unsealed court documents show that a Tennessee man arrested in connection with the January 6, 2021 insurrection conspired with another person in a failed attempt to kill dozens of federal agents involved in the investigation. More than 880 people have been charged with crimes relating to the attack on 6th of January 2021. The Justice Department has said. Earlier this year, Edward Kelly, a 33-year-old, was one of many people arrested on suspicion of illegally entering the U.S. Capitol and assaulting a police officer. According to the FBI, Edward Kelly later discussed plans with 26-year-old Austin Carter to kill law enforcement personnel who had worked in his criminal investigation and made a list of targets. Court records show that a witness provided the list of 37 names to a local Tennessee police department on Tuesday. "You guys are taking them out at their office," said Edward Kelly, who was allegedly recorded by the unidentified witness on Wednesday. "What you and Austin need to do is recruit as many as you can, call who you need to, and you're going to attack their office." When the witness asked if the attack was taking place at the Knoxville office, Edward Kelly replied yes. Austin Carter later told the witness that this is the time, add up or put up, and to definitely make sure you got everything racked, locked up and loaded. Attorneys for Edward Kelly and Austin Carter did not immediately return messages for comment. Edward Kelly and Austin Carter made their appearance in court on Friday, 16th of December, in Knoxville, before U.S. Magistrate Judge Jill McCook. They are charged with conspiracy, retaliating against a federal official, interstate communication of a threat, and solicitation to commit a crime of violence. The Washington Post has also covered the same story. A self-described poster boy for the 6th of January 2021 Capitol riot, who led a mob pursuit of U.S. Capitol Police officer Eugene Goodman, was sentenced on Friday to 5 years in prison after a judge said he had led events that could have caused mass bloodshed. Douglas Jensen, a 43-year-old from Des Moines, Iowa, became one of the most recognized riot participants in widely shared video showing him wearing a black QAnon Eagle t-shirt and leading a crowd following police officer Goodman up two flights of stairs inside the Capitol while searching for the evacuated Senate chamber. "I wanted QAnon to get the attention," Douglas Jensen told the FBI after his arrest. "I basically intended on being the poster boy." "You put yourself at the forefront of the mob," U.S. District Judge Timothy Kelly told Douglas Jensen in court on Friday. "There was nothing patriotic about it, no matter how much you might not have liked how the process of electing a president was perceived." U.S. District Judge Timothy Kelly noted that Douglas Jensen traveled to Washington with others, carrying military-style rifles, was one of the first 10 people who breached the Capitol and waved on and encouraged others to join him. The judge said America's freedoms of speech, petition, and protest carry the responsibility of doing so peacefully. "What no one can do under any circumstances is become part of a mob using violence and the threat of violence to disrupt Congress's ability to fulfill its role to process the certification of the electoral vote. That's what you did," Judge Kelly said. "It's a miracle that more people were not injured and did not lose their lives on that day. What would have happened if that group you led turned the other way into a chamber full of senators? God only knows."
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, sisters and brothers from all around the world, this is IRIB English Radio, and today I have the pleasure to be the host of this episode of Point of View. I'm Beta at your service, and with me I have two dear guest speakers, my dear brother Ali. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And my dear brother, Muhammad, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's my pleasure too to have you in here in this controversial discussion, which I'm really interested in. And so, as you know, we're talking about non-Islamic countries. In non-Islamic countries, there are different methods, but Islamic methods are somehow limited, as you know. For the Islamic education, we lack somehow methods, we lack something, because this is non-Islamic countries, as you know. Then the majority of people are not Muslim, so this is so natural. I mean, but the question is that actually, which method are you using? Not only you, but other people in non-Islamic countries. What are they doing about this education? And in this method, where does it come from? Is it a method, or they are trying to actually create a way for this Islamic education?
You see, as we speak in non-Islamic countries, you see, normally the Muslims that are there, they have communities. Mm-hmm. And this community really helps out not only in the Islamic education of the children, but also the cultural, in preserving the cultural values of the families there. And these communities really do have a lot of effect in education. Not only the programs they have, but in most cases you would find these communities do also have schools specific for Muslims, right? Although the curriculum and the syllabus is government approved and it comes from somewhere else, it's not necessarily Islamic, the teachers and so on in these Islamic schools, because they're from an Islamic background, they know exactly what to teach, how to teach, and what to avoid teaching, what to teach in a different way. Yeah. All of this is. But in certain communities where this privilege isn't there, where they don't have schools, they have other ways. For example, they implement Sunday schools. Just like how the Christians are trying to preserve their religion through Sunday schools, Muslims, considering the 5 days that the students go to, whatever they learn, it's on their own. Mm-hmm. Mostly they're, you know, physics, chemistry, mathematics, the education that is required for their life. But then when it comes to the guidance on Sundays, they normally have Quran and other Islamic education that really kind of reimburses. But is this the way? In my opinion, no. There is a lot more to be done about Islamic education. Exactly. The first and the foremost and the most important one is the syllabus and curriculum. The education system itself should become an Islamic one. Yes, these Sunday schools, they do help preserve the culture and values, Islamic values of that child in that society living, especially when we consider that their entire environment is non-Islamic. The culture that they take in from around them is somewhat a culture that is not accepted by Islam, but they do help in Islamic schools, but in the Sunday schools. But when you look at the syllabus itself, the damage that is done through the syllabus, it cannot be reimbursed just by Sunday schools. Mm-hmm. The things that they learn in social studies, in geography, in history during the week can't be just reimbursed in one day Sunday school with reading Quran. The syllabus itself has to entirely, you know, change.
You, brother, I'm telling you that, okay, for example, imagine that I'm in a non-Islamic country, and for example, I have a child that I want to brought up, I want to bring up in another country which is not Muslim. So there should be something, there should be a guideline, there should be a true thing, you know, that I have to go through that and, you know, just choose to educate that child. So apart from these matters, I have to be sure from the practical part, you know. I know education, for example, is amazing. Education is perfect. The content is perfect. The method is perfect. But how can I be sure about the matter that I'm doing it practically? Can I be sure about that? And the thing that my child going through the society and this child actually is answering to this method. You know what? I'm telling you that, let's think in this way that there are good teachers, there are good methods, but how can we be sure that these are good?
Look, while you are living in a non-Muslim country, so you don't have that much options to choose among good or good system or bad systems. So I think to some extent you have to choose either this one or the other one. I mean, as the brother said, there are some Islamic schools that they have their own method. Yeah. And these Islamic schools, again, there are different denominations, different followers of different denominations from different sects. So then you are, as you are living in a country that there is no other Islamic schools, you are obliged to put your kid in that school. So it has its own limitations. So in case you are living there, I think you have to compensate at home through Sunday classes, I don't know, or Sunday schools for your kid, and to compensate for the kind of, I don't know, desired education, desired Islamic education that you are looking for. But in case you are talking about the system that we have it inside this country, so look, even we do not believe that this system of education that is being practiced here is 100% Islamic.
Yeah,
so it's true that we, alhamdulillah, worked on it to some extent last 40 years. So at least we have something which is, I mean, from the viewpoint of presentation of materials and the content production, is to some extent, at least it is pure. I mean, we can claim that in case our kids, our students are studying there, so they will not face, I mean, any, at least cultural and cultural problems. Or, yeah. I mean, they will not face some issues which are against the values or the Islamic or, the local values of the country or the nation, right?
Yeah.
So, at least to some, alhamdulillah, we resolve them. But to reach to that final, to that destination that we are actually looking after, that is a quite comprehensive educational system based on Islamic norms and Islamic values. So I think we have a long way to go.
Yeah, actually we have a long way to go. But let me ask you another question. For example, we have different concepts at schools. I don't know, for example, we study mathematics, study chemistry, and so on. But I want to ask you, religion should be a part of it or not? Should be a part of it or not, you mm-hmm. know? And this is a matter, I think, because, you know, if you are a man of thinking, if you are a man of going through something and mm-hmm. finding your answers, you will go through the biology, you will go through the mathematics. You don't need someone to tell you that, okay, this is Islam and this is so on. You will go through it yourself. And I what I want to tell you is that we have to make the educational system in a way that the student mm-hmm. Feels the need to go through this topic. Mm-hmm. You know, we shouldn't force her or him. We shouldn't tell her.
Let me answer you with a verse of the Holy Quran. Mm-hmm. A verse of the Quran in Surah Al-Jum'ah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَالَّذِي بَعَثَ فَلَهُمِّينَ رَسُولًا مِنْهُمْ يَتْلُ عَلَيْهِمْ آيَاتِ وَزَكِّيهِمْ وَيُعَلِّمُهُ الْكِتَابَ وَالْحِكْمَةِ. So what is the priority of education here? The priority of education, unlike what you said, is not to go through biology, chemistry, math. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says,
yuzakihim,
yeah. First, they have to purify themselves, to work on their own selves.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the priority of education.
Yeah. But
second,
actually,
oh wait.
Okay.
Second, when you have purified yourself enough, then you can go towards to learn others. This is because we have two different kinds of knowledges or two different kinds of education that are recommended for us. One is compulsory one is recommended one. As for the compulsory, we have to learn what are our duties from an Islamic perspective, what are our duties in this world. It is an obligation on you.
Yeah.
So it is prior to all other, educational and education or trainings, right? So you have this priority first. This is not even something that comes later. No, it has to come earlier, sooner. So you have to learn first. So in our country, we have actually devised a system that we have injected, it's a good term. We have put all these Islamic trainings and Islamic education inside their syllabus and curricula.
Yeah.
So I think it is still a good, one step ahead in comparison to non-Muslim countries, because they have omitted at least these religious teachings of theirs. You see, that's why they left everything for the Sundays. Even they never take part or participate in Sunday programs, even in churches or, I don't know, their religious centers. So they left all these education for Sundays, mm-hmm. but they don't even pay attention to that. Yeah. Right? But alhamdulillah,
it's kind of like a supplementary education for them.
Yeah. Do you agree with me or no? Find your question? I think it's still...
Let me take
a different perspective in answering your question.
Yeah, I'm all ear.
The issue when we look at, for example, saying should there be religious education in the syllabus, mm-hmm.
or should there be any form of religion in the education, is an issue that is kind of paradoxical. Why? Because the definition of religion is unfortunately a very secular definition that we have in our common layman terms. So when we say religion, we refer to the worshipping acts in the mosques, in the synagogues, in the churches, and so on, in the temples. And we define religion to be only that that worshipping act and that believing act on God Almighty. We don't understand that Islam as a deen, at least in the Arabic terminology, means way of life. Much more than just worship, but how you should act with your parents, how you should act with your colleagues, how you should act with your... In addition to that, it's Islam's and the religion's main goal is to what? As the brother mentioned, yuzakihim, is to purify oneself. You might be the world's best mathematician with the least morality.
Yeah.
You might be, you know...
They have many examples.
Exactly. Yeah, you have many. For example, I think in one of the other programs we mentioned about Newton. Yeah exactly. Isaac Newton. He was Isaac Newton, as we all know him, one of the inventors or the theory makers of gravity. But his morality, trash.
Zero.
Right?
Yeah.
So God Almighty, when we talk about education, right, we have to understand Islamic religious education is not just is not something other than mathematics, physics, and chemistry.
Yeah.
Rather, it includes, if time permits, I'm going to open this topic, and it's a topic that is very interesting, I think, that is there something called Islamic mathematics? Is there something called Islamic physics? Is there something called Islamic chemistry? And how is it? How do you picture this? Do you mean that, okay, in Islamic physics, you're also going to learn that, you know, for example, when an apple falls from the tree, the gravity is proven, God says there, you know, picture that? It's actually a very interesting topic. When we say that the syllabus itself should be Islamic, we mean that there is something called Islamic physics. Right? We have, and if we're talking about this, I think the major subject that will face, the secular subject that will face big difficulties would be social studies.
There was something really beautiful in your speech that I really appreciate that. And it was that we are actually misunderstanding the meaning of religion and the meaning of Islam. And this is actually the main problem that, and the root of the problems that we have with this education system or whatever. And this is religion is lifestyle. And if you think in any other way, it means that you have to go through this topic and search more about that. And, you know, thank you, both brothers, for discussing this matter with me. And I was really kind of you, and I really enjoyed it. And right now, I think, as the gist of our discussion here, we need to actually correct the educational system in many ways. We lack many things. But actually, there is a long way to go. But we have time, we have resources, we have everything to make it better, and I'm sure about that. And we are here, the young generation is here to make it better in any way, especially in Islamic, actually, manners and Islamic educations. Thank you for listening to IRIB English Radio. I wish you enjoy the topic of today. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa
Shining bright, you came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, accept that. يقولها لنا يوم القيامة أمتي أمتي يقولها شفاعة أنا لها أنا لها
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., the Transportation Security Administration, TSA, has said it has recovered 6,301 firearms from airport security checkpoints so far this year, as of Friday, 16th of December, more than 88% of which were loaded. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. CBS News has covered this story. Transportation Security Administration officers have confiscated 6,301 firearms from airport passengers so far in 2022, the highest number recorded since the agency's inception. Of those guns taken at airport security checkpoints, 88% were loaded, the agency announced on Friday, 16th of December. The Transportation Security Administration, TSA, said it expects to have confiscated about 6,600 firearms by the end of this year, which would mark a 10.5% increase from the 5,972 firearms seized in 2021, which was also a record. The agency also reported on Friday that it was raising the maximum civil penalty for a firearms violation from $13,910 to $14,950. The top five airports for firearms stops so far this year, according to the Transportation Security Administration, TSA, were the Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport, the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport, Houston's George Bush Intercontinental Airport, Nashville International Airport, and the Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport. Nashville had the highest rate of firearm confiscation per capita, according to a TSA spokesperson. In April, Representative Madison Cawthorn was cited for attempting to bring a gun through security at the Charlotte Douglas International Airport in North Carolina, according to local police. Madison Cawthorn admitted the firearm was his and cooperated with officers, according to police. He was issued a citation for possession of a dangerous weapon on city property. According to the Transportation Security Administration policy, individuals toting either loaded firearms or unloaded firearms with accessible ammunition can face fines starting at $3,000, plus a criminal referral to law enforcement. Those with aggravating circumstances, including a history of carrying loaded weapons into security checkpoints, could be forced to shell out the maximum fine. The Transportation Security Administration will grant civil penalty action only after completing an investigation. If passengers violate state laws, TSA refers cases to local authorities. The Transportation Security Administration also revokes its pre-check eligibility for at least 5 years for passengers caught with a firearm and routinely conducts enhanced screening for those passengers to ensure no other threats are present. ABC News has also covered the same story, giving us more details. The Transportation Security Administration, TSA, confiscated a record number of guns at checkpoints in 2022, most of which were loaded, as the agency has increased the maximum fine for firearm violations. The Transportation Security Administration, TSA, said it has recovered 6,301 firearms from airport security checkpoints so far this year, as of Friday, 16th of December, more than 88% of which were loaded. That surpasses the previous record of 5,972 firearms detected in 2021. TSA said it anticipates it will have intercepted some 6,600 firearms in carry-on bags by the end of 2022, which would be a nearly 10% increase over 2021's record level. The agency also announced on Friday, 16th of December, that it has increased the maximum fine for firearm violations to $14,950 to reduce the threat of firearms at checkpoints. Previously, the maximum fine was $13,910. I applaud the work of our transportation security officers who do an excellent job of preventing firearms from getting into the security area of airports and onboard aircraft, TSA Administrator David Pekoske said in a statement. Pekoske added, when a passenger brings a firearm to the checkpoint, this can consume significant security resources and poses a potential threat to transportation security, in addition to being very costly for the passenger. Firearms or ammunition are not allowed in carry-on bags at any TSA security checkpoint, even if a passenger has a concealed weapon permit. Transportation Security Administration regulations do allow passengers to transport unloaded firearms in checked baggage. Travelers must comply with state possession laws and are required to declare their firearms to airline personnel when checking in, among other requirements. Firearms detected in carry-on bags are turned over to local law enforcement authorities. Passengers who bring firearms to a checkpoint could face a fine, with repeat violations resulting in higher penalties. Offending travelers may also potentially face arrest by law enforcement officers depending on state or local laws. The firearms record comes as the Transportation Security Administration is seeing the volume of travelers rebounding to, if not surpassing, pre-COVID-19 pandemic levels. The website of Forbes magazine, Forbes.com, also has covered the same story. As of Friday, 16th of December, Transportation Security Administration officers across the country have intercepted a record 6,301 firearms at airport security checkpoints in 2022, according to the TSA. With just weeks left in December, the TSA expects a total tally of 6,600 firearms in carry-on bags by the end of the year. That will be about a 10% increase over 2021's previous record of 5,972 firearms and more than a 400% jump compared to a decade ago. Last year, a senior TSA official called out an epidemic of guns at our airports. But what is driving this epidemic? In 2021 and 2022, a wave of states, including Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Indiana, Iowa, Montana, Ohio, Tennessee, Texas, and Utah, passed laws no longer requiring residents to hold a permit to carry a concealed firearm. A legislative priority for the National Rifle Association, NRA, and other groups, permitless carry measures are now in place in half of all states. These new laws, combined with soaring travel demand in the third year of the COVID-19 pandemic, are contributing to an increase in guns at airports across the country, according to experts. We've got a significant rise in the population of new, never-before gun owners, and then we have a significant rise in new air travelers, a TSA official told Forbes magazine. Getting caught with a firearm at an airport checkpoint carries a civil fine of $1,500, according to TSA guidance, if the gun is loaded, as 88% of them are, according to the agency, then the fine jumps to $3,000. For repeat offenders, the TSA is bumping up the maximum potential penalty from $14,000 to $14,950. And that's not including lawyers' fees. Over the past 3 years, the Transportation Security Administration, TSA, has levied more than $52 million in civil penalties against travelers caught with guns at airports. As of October of this year, penalties had already topped $20 million for 2022. Firearm possession laws vary by state and local government, but firearms are never allowed in carry-on bags at any TSA security checkpoint, even if a passenger has a concealed weapon permit.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.